Hey guys, and welcome to another episode of Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. I want to thank you for joining me today, and if you're a returning listener, I want to say a big thank you for your continued support. If this is your first time listening to my podcast, welcome. It's great to have you on board. So without further ado, let's get started on today's story.
Ireland Crimes and Mysteries is presented by Go Loud, Ireland's leading audio publisher and the home of Irish podcasts. Find new episodes on the podcast first on the Go Loud app and on your favourite podcast platform. This episode discusses the abduction and murder of a child, including references to sexual violence. Listener discretion is strongly advised. On the 23rd of February 1970, a 10-year-old girl sat in her classroom in Lacca National School, County Sligo, and wrote a description of herself in her English copybook. Her handwriting was neat, the margins carefully ruled with a pencil. Her teacher, Mrs. Kearns, would have been pleased. She wrote, "My name is Bernadette Connolly. My address is Dourla, Clooney, County Sligo, Éire. My age is 10. My birthday is on the 1st of August. I was born in the year 1959. I have two sisters. I have one brother. My sisters' names are Anne and Patricia. My brother's name is Tommy. I want to be a teacher when I grow up. I have brown hair. I have curly hair. I have brown eyes. I have glasses." Less than 2 months later, on Friday, the 17th of April 1970, Bernadette Connolly would leave her home on a simple errand for her mother. She would cycle past a neighbour on a horse and cart, calling out hello through the rain. She would never arrive at her destination. For 112 days, Bernadette's family, the Gardaí, and the local community searched desperately for the little girl with the red and gold bicycle and the pink-rimmed glasses. What they didn't know was that somewhere in the rural landscape of County Sligo, hidden in bogland just 200 yards from the main road, lay the answer to where Bernadette had gone. But who took her there, and why, remains a mystery to this day. It was a wet Friday afternoon when Bernadette disappeared. While most of the country was captivated by the dramatic television pictures of Apollo 13, the spacecraft limping back to Earth after a near catastrophic explosion, a different kind of crisis was unfolding in a small village outside Clooney. The 17th of April 1970 was a day that would shatter a family, traumatise a community, and expose disturbing questions about power, protection, and justice in 1970s Ireland. This is the story of Bernadette Connolly. A story of a devout little girl who loved Irish dancing and dreamed of becoming a teacher. A story of a massive investigation that identified multiple suspects but never made an arrest. A story of critical evidence that mysteriously disappeared from Garda custody. And a story of a father who, until his death nearly 30 years later, believed he knew who murdered his daughter, but was, in his own words, afraid of that 1% of doubt. I'm Niels, and this is Ireland Crimes and Mysteries. Birmingham, England, the 1st of August, 1959. That's where and when Bernadette Connolly came into the world. The second daughter in what would become a family of six children. Though fate would be cruel to the Connollys in ways they couldn't yet imagine. Her father Jerry had left his native County Sligo for work in England. Her mother Maureen was from Kerry originally, but had crossed the Irish Sea as a teenager seeking opportunity. They'd found each other in 1950s London, eventually settling in Aston, a neighbourhood in North Birmingham where Irish emigrants had built a thriving community. Jerry became a well-known figure there, taking the role of MC at Feshanna, those grand celebrations of Irish culture and dance. When St. Patrick's Day came around each year, the Connollys were among the organisers. Their first child, Anne, arrived in 1956. Bernadette followed 3 years on. Then came Tommy in 62. Life in Birmingham was good. The Irish Dancing School, where Anne and Bernadette learned their steps, the tight circle of friends, many of them fellow Irish families, steady work, a community. But something troubled Gerry and Maureen deeply. The city had seen children murdered, one killed directly across from the girls' school. For parents, especially emigrant parents who'd crossed a sea to build better lives, this fear gnawed at them. They made a decision that would haunt them forever. Ireland would be safer for their children. The mid-60s saw the Connollys return to Sligo. Gerry had skills as a heating and plumbing contractor, and he saw opportunity in the Colooney and Ballymote area. It took 12 months to establish himself before Maureen could bring the children across. Anne was 8 by then, Bernadette 5, Tommy 3. Another daughter, Patricia, would be born in Ireland. They found a cottage in Dorla, roughly 3 miles from Colooney, on the Boyle Road. Plans were underway for something better, a proper two-storey semi-detached house closer to town. But in early 1970, it wasn't ready yet. January 1969 brought devastating sorrow. Maureen delivered a baby boy, Gerard. 10 days later, he was gone. The grief would still be raw when April of 1970 would arrive. What kind of a child was Bernadette? She was deeply faithful. Her bedroom held a small collection of holy statues and religious medals. 3 medals in particular went everywhere with her, safety pinned to her vest. She never removed them. She couldn't see well without her glasses. Thick pink frames that in most family photos she'd removed to smile at the camera. Curly brown hair with reddish tones at the front, brown eyes, freckles scattered across her face. At 10 years old, she stood around 4'9", maybe 4'10". Christmas of 1969 had brought her greatest treasure, a rally astronaut bicycle, gleaming red and gold. She adored that bike, spent every chance she could riding it. Dancing was her passion. The Mary Healy School of Dancing had trained her well. She'd won medals, performed at festivals. Her best friend was Mary Flynn. In school, she sat beside Patsy Kearns and counted Anne Kearns, Rita Sweeney and another girl, Anne Sweeney, among her close friends. Geography placed the Connolly home near Clonamahan, a former sanatorium transformed into St. Joseph's Retreat, run by the Passionists' Order. 22 priests and brothers lived there in 1970. The monastery ran a youth club that both Bernadette and Anne attended regularly. They also went to novenas honouring Mary Garotti, a 12-year-old Italian girl martyred during a sexual assault in 1890, later made a saint with the Passionists' strong advocacy. To the religious men at Clumahan, Bernadette was a familiar trusted face, a gentle devout child who belonged to their community. Her school copybooks revealed flashes of her mind. Writing about her hometown, she catalogued Colooney's features, the pubs and drapery shops, the butchers and the grocery store. She noted the Garda barracks, the houses where married guards lived, the lodgings for bachelor guards, 5 Gardaí in total. An essay on Rain showed practical wisdom beyond her years. Only for Rain, we would be dead. We would not have anything to eat. Wheat and potatoes need water, she said in one of her copybooks. About school playtime, she observed the boys' territorial anger when girls crossed their football pitch. The girls sometimes play mammies and daddies, she wrote. I like school playtime. It is the best time of the whole day's school. When severe storms battered Ireland in November 69 and teachers asked students to describe them, Bernadette wrote about disrupted electricity, about posts and telegraphs workers fixing downed telephone lines. She captured the wildness, wind, rain, thunder. Her sister Anne had witnessed a lightning strike during that storm. Bernadette made sure to include that detail. She was a bright child, imaginative, religious to her core. A dancer who'd won medals, a girl who treasured her new bicycle and harboured dreams of teaching someday, a girl who'd just lost her infant brother, growing up in a tight-knit rural Sligo community, surrounded by her family. Her parents had crossed the Irish Sea believing they were bringing their children to safety. Friday, the 17th of April, 1970 would prove them catastrophically wrong. That particular day was a wet, miserable day across County Sligo. Rain had been falling steadily since morning. Persistent Irish rain that soaks through everything. Inside the Connolly cottage at Dorla, Bernadette had been recovering from an illness. She'd missed school the previous few days with an allergy, but she was feeling better now, looking forward perhaps to getting back on her beloved bicycle after being cooped up indoors. The timing of what happened next would prove unbelievably precise. That afternoon, while most of Ireland sat transfixed by their television sets watching Apollo 13's dramatic splashdown in the Pacific Ocean, the spacecraft having barely survived an oxygen tank explosion that nearly killed its crew, Maureen Connolly realised she needed items for their tea: smoked haddock and potatoes. Her friend Ellen Malloy had mentioned earlier that day she was heading into town to do some shopping, and Maureen asked her to pick up some fish. Ellen had agreed. Ellen Malloy lived 2.5 miles away in Lissanina. Shortly before 4:30 that afternoon, Maureen made the decision that would haunt her for the rest of her life. She asked her daughter Bernadette to cycle to Ellen's house to collect the messages and gave her daughter her purse containing 10 shillings and 2 pence to pay for the fish and potatoes. Bernadette was delighted, a chance to ride her rally astronaut, her Christmas prize. She pulled on her brown corduroy anorak with its hood. Underneath she wore her blue blouse and light brown pinafore dress with box pleats, a white vest with those 3 religious medals pinned to it, her thick pink rimmed glasses, light brown woolen gloves against the rain. She tucked her mother's purse into the front basket of her bike. "Bye, Mom," she called out, her last words to her mother. Bernadette cycled away from home around 4:30. The journey to Ellen Malloy's house required her to first head towards Clooney and then to turn left onto Lissanina Road. But there were 2 ways to make that turn. She could take the lake road that ran alongside Clunamahan Monastery's grounds, separated from the monastery by a high embankment, or she could take a shortcut directly through the monastery grounds themselves. Nobody knows which route Bernadette chose that day. What we do know is this. At some point along that journey, she cycled past 12-year-old Oliver Flynn and his mother Kathleen, who were delivering coal by donkey and cart. It was raining quite heavily at this point. Bernadette had her hood up. She called out hello to them as she pedalled past, cycling at a good pace. She was heading in the direction of Clunamahan. That was the last confirmed sighting of Bernadette Connolly alive. Within minutes, perhaps seconds of passing the Flynns, someone would intercept her. The abduction happened with terrifying speed. No one in the vicinity reported hearing screams or cries for help. Men were working in fields nearby. Surely they would have heard a child crying or the screeching of tyres. The most likely explanation is that Bernadette was either punched or knocked unconscious and then taken. Or perhaps she recognised her abductor. Perhaps she trusted them. Bernadette never arrived at Ellen Malloy's house. After 5:30, when Bernadette hadn't returned, Maureen sent her older sister Anne to check. Anne cycled the route to the Malloy's, and when she arrived, Ellen thought she was joking at first when Anne asked had Bernadette turned up for the fish. But the concern quickly turned real. Ellen's 13-year-old daughter, Patricia, joined Anne, and together the two girls retraced the journey along Lissanina Road. Then Anne spotted something. 4 or 5 feet up on an embankment, the handlebars of a bike caught her eye. Something shiny. The two girls climbed up. Anne recognised it immediately. It was Bernadette's bicycle, the new rally astronaut, carefully placed, not thrown, up on the bank above the narrow road. And there, lying in a small hole in the ground, was Maureen's purse. The 10 shillings and 2 pence still inside. Anne knew instantly that something was catastrophically wrong. There was no possibility that 10-year-old Bernadette could have placed that bike where it was. The position was too high, too deliberate. Panic set in. Anne's mind raced through possibilities, each one more terrifying than the last. She and Patricia Malloy cycled back towards the Connolly's house as fast as they could, out of breath from exertion and fear. They met Anne's father, Jerry, along the way. Anne had to tell him that Bernadette was missing, that her bike had been abandoned, that something terrible had happened. Maureen Connolly came out of the house when she realised Bernadette wasn't with Anne. When the truth sank in that her daughter was gone, that the bike and purse had been found, but not Bernadette, Maureen went into hysterics. She began screaming at the top of her voice. A neighbour, Henry King, tried to comfort her, but Maureen was beyond comfort. Her baby was gone. Tommy, who was 8, would later remember that Henry brought them to his house to look at his puppies, trying to shield the younger children from what was happening. But Tommy could hear people using the word kidnapped. Jerry noticed something when he arrived at the scene where the bike had been found. There in the mud were a man's footprints and a child's footprints as well. Maureen had already phoned the local Garda sergeant by the time Jerry and Anne returned. Within minutes, a Garda from Colooney Station arrived at the scene with another guard. They immediately grasped the gravity of the situation. As they drove down the lane, they could see that half a dozen people were already gathered where Bernadette's bike and purse had been discovered. Fearing the worst, but hoping for the best, they moved people away from the bicycle and purse to preserve whatever evidence remained. They organised an immediate search of the surrounding fields in case Bernadette was lying injured somewhere close by. Within minutes, it became clear that she was nowhere in the immediate vicinity. The Garda sergeant went up the lane to find the nearest house with a telephone and alerted Sligo Station. From that moment on, as evening fell on April 17, 1970, and families across Ireland watched the Apollo 13 astronauts safely return to Earth, a very different kind of emergency was beginning to unfold a few miles south of Colooney. Extensive searches began that very evening. Friends and neighbours helped the Gardaí scour fields, rivers and lanes around the Lysanina Road. Among those searching were many of the 22 priests and brothers at Clunamahan Monastery. Bernadette had disappeared within half a mile of the monastery. She was a familiar face to the religious men there, a child who attended their youth club, who came to their novenas, who they knew as devout and gentle. Throughout the night, as the rain continued to fall, the searches went on, but nothing was found. By early Saturday morning, the 18th of April, almost every Garda in the Sligo district had been drafted in. The local superintendent called Garda headquarters in Dublin. Within hours, members of the murder squad arrived in County Sligo to coordinate what was now being treated as a major investigation. There had never been anything like it in recent memory. There had been instances of children attacked in random assaults, but no case of a child being abducted in Ireland like this. Officially, detectives were classifying it as a missing persons case. Privately, many feared that Bernadette had been murdered. The investigation moved with unprecedented scale and speed. Detectives arranged for Bernadette's bicycle to be examined for fingerprints. They found a finger mark just below the saddle, which appeared to have been made in grease or oil. This triggered a massive fingerprinting operation. Eventually, they would fingerprint every person who might have had access to the bike, as well as more than 500 other people living in the locality or believed to have travelled close to where Bernadette disappeared on April the 17th. But one detail troubled investigators from the very beginning. The bicycle had been placed carefully up on the embankment, not dumped or thrown. It hadn't been hidden in bushes, but rather seemed to have been handled with care. Why? Did this suggest that Bernadette's abductor knew her? That he had perhaps offered to drive her the rest of her journey and maybe help her collect her bike afterwards? It had been raining so hard that maybe when someone she recognised, someone she trusted, pulled up alongside her, She accepted their offer of help. Did this person explain to her that it would be safe up on the bank, away from the road? Or was the truth much darker than that? Was it that the person who placed the bike up on the embankment and did so so carefully because his real intention was that he planned to attack Bernadette and he didn't want her bike to be found easily? That placing it carefully on the bank was a deliberate act to buy himself some time. The investigation into Bernadette Connolly's disappearance had begun. It would become one of the largest missing persons inquiries Ireland had ever seen. But as the hours turned into days and the days into weeks, Bernadette remained missing. And somewhere in the bog in County Sligo, hidden from view, lay the terrible truth of what had happened to her. The search for Bernadette Connolly consumed County Sligo through the spring and into summer of 1970. By May, all lakes and rivers in the area around Colony had been searched by the Garda Water Unit. Vacant houses had been searched, sand pits, septic tanks, sewerage systems, coal bunkers, every conceivable hiding place. Tracker dogs from Dublin scoured the countryside. Nothing. Maureen Connolly had provided detectives with a detailed description of every piece of clothing her daughter had been wearing. The descriptions had been circulated to every Garda station in the country. The RUC were also contacted. British police were alerted in case Bernadette had been abducted and taken out of the country on a ferry. Gardaí issued questionnaires to try to establish what vehicles might have been in the area at the time of Bernadette's disappearance. 14 people came forward to say they had travelled the Colony Boyle Road or other nearby roads at about the time of Bernadette's disappearance, but no one had seen the 10-year-old little girl. The last definitive sighting remained Kathleen Flynn and her son Oliver, not too far from where the bicycle and the purse had been found. Among the vehicles that investigators were particularly interested in were several vans and cars reported to have been seen in the area. Some of these vehicles were never properly identified and remain lines of inquiry to this day. Witnesses reported seeing a dark green Ford Escort van in the area on April the 17th. A similar type of van was owned by Clunamahan Monastery, which possessed some farmland and provided a local milk delivery service. The Gardaí questioned everyone at the monastery. None of the priests, brothers or lay workers could definitively account for the monastery van between 4:30 and 25 minutes past 7 that evening. Other vehicles were never adequately identified, including a white Zephyr, a black Hillman Hunter and a blue Anglia. As the investigation moved into its second month, then its third, and with no leads emerging, detectives from the murder squad had to return to Dublin to work on other cases. None of the fingerprints taken from more than 500 people matched the print found on Bernadette's bike. While the Gardaí believed some people were being evasive in their answers during questioning, there was nothing to firmly indicate who might be responsible for the 10-year-old's abduction. In the weeks and months after Bernadette's disappearance, there were constant visitors to the Connolly house. Neighbours brought biscuits and sandwiches, did whatever they could to help. Gerry and Maureen received countless letters and postcards of support from people throughout the country. They wrote a standard but heartfelt reply, thanking people for their consolation and encouragement. But as spring turned into summer, hope began to fade. Then, on Tuesday, the 4th of August, 1970, came the discovery that would break what remained of the Connolly family's hearts. Margaret O'Connor was loading turf at the bog in Limna, on the border between County Roscommon and County Sligo. It was a warm, dry day. Margaret was working close to a narrow sand road just north of the Curlew Mountains. As she paused for breath, she suddenly got a very bad smell. She thought it must have been a dead animal and soon left the bog and headed home. 2 days later, Margaret returned to the bog and again detected the bad smell. She was standing on the roadside and knew by the smell that the source couldn't be far away. She decided to investigate. Walking up onto a turf bank between the narrow road and the surrounding bogland on her left-hand side, She walked along the embankment, studying the bog carefully as she went. She had travelled only a short distance when she looked into a bog drain and saw teeth and small bones. Margaret O'Connor knew immediately what she had found. For 112 days, Bernadette Connolly's body had lain hidden in Limna Bog, 15 miles from the quiet lane where she'd been abducted. For those 16 weeks, her body had lain just 200 yards from the main road. Thousands of vehicles would have travelled along the Boyle Ballymote Road from the end of April until early August. But no one except Bernadette's killer knew the little girl's remains were hidden a short distance away up the narrow Limna Road. Margaret phoned Boyle Garda Station. When Sergeant John Cuff arrived at the scene, he knew immediately that the remains were human. He cordoned off the area and contacted his superiors. What was found in that bog drain was heartbreaking. Bernadette was still wearing her white vest with her three religious medals pinned to it. She was also wearing her brown anorak and blue blouse and her pinafore dress. But animals had tampered with Bernadette's body as it lay in Limna Bog. Her body would have been intact when her killer obviously left her hidden there. But by the time her remains were recovered, Bernadette's legs and right arm were gone. Also missing were her underwear, tights and slip. Her shoes and glasses were also not at the bog. A 9-carat gold signet ring she wore on her right middle finger was never found. A neighbour and a relative of the Connollys were asked to go to Limna Bog to provisionally identify Bernadette's clothing. They confirmed that the anorak, white vest with medals and the pinafore dress were similar to those worn by the missing 10-year-old. Back in Clooney, a journalist had phoned the Connolly house from Dublin early that Thursday morning to ask if there were any developments in the case. The newspaper hadn't phoned in quite a while, and though the reporter made it seem like a routine call, with hindsight, Anne Connolly believes the reporter had heard something. Later that morning, another journalist rang. When the second call came, Maureen Connolly was now getting really concerned. The family was getting Patricia dressed, putting her hair back in a ponytail. They were getting ready to cycle to Clooney. Through the window, Maureen saw Father Duffy and some neighbours and Gardaí coming up the road. She stood at the front door and started screaming. Oh, Jesus Christ, they found her. Maureen knew they weren't coming with a priest bearing good news. Jerry Connolly was working in Tubbercurry that Thursday. Someone was sent to find him and break the news. Meanwhile, people were trying to console his wife in Clooney. Anne remembers that her mother was yet again hysterical. Anne herself was 13 years old. She remembers screaming and crying and a Garda trying to console her. Her mother was totally distraught, putting her arms around Anne. Anne can remember her saying she was going to kill them all. She said she wanted them all to be with Bernie. People were saying to her that she couldn't do that, that she had other children who needed her. But Maureen just wanted to die. There was no such thing as counselling in those days. You were supposed to control your feelings. On Saturday, the 7th of August, 1970, the assistant state pathologist, Dr. R.B. O'Neill, visited Limna Bog and studied Bernadette's body as it lay in the turf. He noticed a pinkish stain on Bernadette's brown anorak, and he confirmed the belief of detectives that the body had been in the bog for up to 4 months and that Bernadette's killer had brought her to Limna Bog a short time after she'd been abducted. Perhaps he had killed her there, or she may have been dead by the time her killer took her from his car or his van and left her lying in the bog. Dr. O'Neill and the detectives noted that all the items of Bernadette's clothing that were missing were from below the waist. It would be 6 or 7 years after Bernadette was murdered before it dawned on her older sister Anne that she may have been sexually assaulted. Anne was in Clooney when someone asked her if Bernadette had been raped. It was only when this question was put to her that she thought about it. It hit her like a slap in the face. Bernie had never even kissed a boy. Bernadette's body was removed from Limna Bog and taken to Boyle District Hospital, where a post-mortem examination was carried out. Because of the length of time the body lay undiscovered, it was not possible to give an exact cause of death. Without doubt, she had been murdered, but it could not be established whether she'd been beaten or attacked with an implement or whether she had been strangled. The three medals were removed from Bernadette's vest and placed in a small glass box. Detectives wanted to show her family the medals to further identify the little girl's remains. As I said, Bernadette had been a religious girl and never went anywhere without her medals. The Gardaí showed the family the medals, then took them away again. They were still part of the evidence in a murder inquiry. On Sunday, the 9th of August, 1970, Bernadette Connolly was laid to rest. Her youngest sister, Patricia, was only 4 years old. Her brother, Tommy, was 8. It was decided they were too young to attend the funeral. Anne, being 13, stood beside her distraught mother and father at Colooney Cemetery. Girls from Bernadette's Irish dancing class led the funeral procession as the white coffin was carried through Colooney. At the graveside, Jerry Connolly held his hand to his face as tears fell. Beside him, Maureen was doubled over in grief, a priest holding her tightly. Anne was broken-hearted too, standing at her mother's shoulder, her eyes fixed on the coffin containing her sister's body. A number of priests stood with the family at the graveside, along with local people and children who stood by silently, watching in sadness and bewilderment as Bernadette's coffin was lowered into the ground. Bernadette Connolly was finally home, but the question of who had taken her life remained unanswered. In the days after Bernadette's body was found, local detectives and members of the murder squad rapidly expanded their investigation. Every male over the age of 15 within an area of 380 square miles was to be asked to account for their movements on April the 17th. With the fingerprint on Bernadette's bicycle still unaccounted for, detectives were directed to take fingerprints from teenagers or men who might have been near the place where Bernadette's bike was abandoned or the place where her body was found. By the end of August, a total of 2,324 sets of fingerprints had been taken. Then came a breakthrough. On the 25th of August, a Garda met a man near Colooney. During a general conversation, the man referred to mass taking of fingerprints and mentioned that he had previously handled the bike. The man's fingerprints had not yet been taken, but when they were, the next day, his print matched the finger mark on the frame of Bernadette's bike. For a moment, investigators believed they might have their killer. The man explained how he had once lifted Bernadette's bicycle and put it in a car when his girlfriend had borrowed it from the Connolly family. The Gardaí investigated this claim thoroughly and eventually established that this man was nowhere near the Lysanina Road when Bernadette vanished. What they thought had been a crucial lead was now defunct. Another line of inquiry that eventually led nowhere was the pinkish stain found on the right sleeve of Bernadette's anorak. When detectives spotted the mark at Limna Bog, they wondered whether it was some type of chemical that might have led to Bernadette's attacker. The forensic science laboratory did not exist at this point, so the anorak was sent to the Institute for Industrial Research and Standards in Dublin. Scientists analysed the pink stain and reported that it was caused by a fungal growth typically found in bogland. With the fingerprint and the anorak stain now adequately explained, the Gardaí were left with no real scientific evidence in the case. Detectives concentrated much of their subsequent inquiries on conflicts in evidence between people who completed questionnaires relating to the case. When such conflicts arose, the Gardaí brought these people face to face in an effort to get to the truth. It would prove to be a futile exercise. In the weeks and months after Bernadette Connolly's body was found, there was simply no breakthrough. But there were suspects, and the investigation would be mired in controversy that basically still persists to this day. One of the many conflicts in witness statements related to whether or not the green van from Clunamahan Monastery had been at a petrol station in a village near Colooney on the evening Bernadette disappeared. The owner of the shop and filling station was adamant that the van had pulled up outside his premises that night. The shopkeeper described how a man he recognised had been driving the van and had asked him to fill it up. The shopkeeper said he remembered it clearly because the night Bernadette disappeared, the television was showing pictures of the Apollo 13 space shuttle coming back to Earth. When detectives spoke to the man who the shopkeeper said was driving the van, he emphatically denied being at the service station that night. He told the Gardaí he had been at the shop on other occasions, but not on the night of April 17th. The shopkeeper died in 1989 and maintained to his death that he had seen the man that night. Another line of inquiry never adequately explained was the blue Anglia car spotted near Ballymote on the day of Bernadette's abduction. A witness came forward after Bernadette's body was found to say that 4 months previously, they had seen a girl sitting in a blue Anglia car near a school close to Ballymote. A man was sitting in the driver's seat and a girl was sitting in the passenger seat while the car was parked on a grass verge on the side of the road. The Gardaí tried to find every blue Anglia in the counties of Sligo, Leitrim, Roscommon and Mayo, but the blue Anglia in question was never identified. These conflicting accounts and unidentified vehicles frustrated investigators. But it was what happened, or rather what didn't happen, regarding Clonmacnoise Monastery that would cast the longest shadow over this case. In the weeks before Bernadette's body was found, a student priest had moved into the Connolly family home. This young man acted as a buffer between the Connolly family and the outside world. He comforted Gerry Connolly during those desperate weeks of searching. Thousands of letters of support had been sent to the Connollys from people around the world, basically, and this man would open their post, saying he wanted to make sure they didn't read unsettling material. He even offered to bring sympathy letters to the Garda station if necessary. The young priest stayed in the Connolly home for weeks. Even when everyone else had left, he remained in the tiny two-bedroomed house. Looking back years later, Bernadette's sister Anne would reflect on how abnormal it seemed that someone would stay in such a small space for so long. When she asked about it at the time, everyone said it was to support her father. Then, in December 1970, just months after Bernadette's body was discovered, this student priest left Ireland. He spent much of his subsequent life in Africa, where he died some years ago. A fellow priest who studied with him in 1970 later met the sisters of Bernadette Connolly and told them it was his firm belief that this man had nothing to do with Bernadette's murder, that he simply would not have had the mentality to attack a young girl. But Gerry Connolly held a different view. Gerry Connolly never publicly mentioned the name of any person he suspected of being involved in his daughter's killing. Before his death in 1999, he had spent 3 decades trying to piece together scraps of information and innuendo, but he died without the answers he longed for. In later years, he confided in friends that even if he was 99% certain he knew who'd killed his child, he would still be more afraid of that 1% of doubt. Gerry often thought about a student priest who had comforted the family in the weeks before Bernadette's body was found. This man, as I said, had acted for a time as a buffer between the Connolly family and the outside world. He had aroused Gerry's curiosity when he suggested to the Gardaí that Bernadette might have been abducted by British forces in an attempt to ensure IRA guns were discovered during searches for the little girl in County Sligo. In other words, that the British security forces had taken Bernadette to force the Gardaí to conduct extensive searches of the area, hoping weapons would be uncovered in the process. There was another unusual incident in the months before Bernadette's body was found. This same man told Gerry Connolly of following a car that was driving suspiciously near Connolly's house. He said the car drove towards Ballinafad, but he then lost sight of it. Where Bernadette's body was later found is not very far from Ballinafad. When Bernadette's body was discovered, detectives from the murder squad arrived back in County Sligo. Their inquiries had reached a brick wall in the weeks after Bernadette disappeared. Now, with the discovery of her body, they had a second crime scene to consider. Considering the geography of the area, the Gardaí determined that there were 3 ways Bernadette's killer could have travelled from the Lysanina Road to Limna Bog. If he had driven up behind Bernadette as she cycled to the Malloy's house. He could have abducted her and continued driving past the Malloy's house to the junction with the road heading south for Ballymote. He could have driven through Ballymote until he crossed the boundary with County Roscommon and then turned left up the Limna Road. Alternatively, having abducted Bernadette, the killer could have turned back towards the junction with the Colooney Road and turned right, travelling past the Connolly's house and driving through Castle Baldwin and Ballinafad before turning right into Limna Bog. The third option, which has long been analysed by Gardaí investigating the case, is that the killer could have travelled the 15 miles to Limna Bog without having to drive along any main road at all. Assuming Bernadette was abducted at the spot where her bicycle and her mother's purse were found, the killer could have turned back and taken an immediate right turn down by the back of Clunamahan Monastery. He could then have driven through the myriad of back roads and boreens, through the townsland of Branchfield and Dubeg, and through the village of Grannymore, and then skirted around the Brickleave Mountains before arriving at Limna Bog. This isolated route may have been the journey favoured by the killer, if Bernadette was crying out or screaming for help. If so, the killer had to be someone with local knowledge of the back roads of South County Sligo. The investigation continued. Detectives concentrated on the conflicts in evidence, particularly those relating to the monastery van. But in October 1970, the Connolly family moved out of the cottage in Dura and into the centre of Colooney. Their newly built house was now fully ready. The electricity wasn't even connected. But within weeks of laying her daughter to rest, Maureen Connolly could not stay in the old house any longer. One of the first things she said when the family arrived at their new house was, "Wouldn't Bernie love this?" The breakthrough that investigators hoped for never came. Unknown at the time of Bernadette Connolly's abduction and murder, a dangerous paedophile from England was travelling through Ireland during part of 1970 and spent a considerable amount of time in South County Sligo. The man in question was from Northampton and wrote for a fishing magazine in England. He was 37 years old when he spent time in Ireland with another man in 1970, driving a dark green van and sampling and reviewing a number of fishing lakes and rivers. At that time, he had no convictions for sexual violence. His only conviction was for minor theft in England 8 years previously. It was 3 years after the abduction and murder of Bernadette Connolly that this man emerged as a possible suspect after he abducted four young Irish girls in four counties. In May 1973, he abducted a nine-year-old girl in County Mayo as she was out cycling. He subjected the girl to a horrific sexual assault before bringing her back to where she had been taken from. The girl was later able to give detectives a detailed description of her attacker and also of the van in which she had been abducted. It was some months before the English fishing journalist was arrested near a lake by alert Gardaí who spotted his van and realised it matched the description of the one used in the attack in County Mayo. By the time he was arrested, he had attacked young girls, as I said, in County Sligo, Cork and Cavan. He admitted the offences and was jailed for 7 years. When detectives investigating the murder of Bernadette Connolly interviewed this man, he said he had not been in the country at the time of the killing. He told them he had arrived in Ireland 8 days after Bernadette's abduction, arriving on the 25th of April 1970. To work on articles for the May edition of the fishing magazine. With nothing to contradict the man's story, the detectives were never able to take the matter further. In June 2003, two detectives from County Sligo travelled to England to meet this man. The then Assistant Commissioner for the North West Region, Kevin Carty, had directed a review of the investigation after Bernadette's sisters contacted the Gardaí with a number of questions about the case. One of their queries was about the extent of the original Garda investigation into this journalist's movements throughout Ireland in the early 1970s. Their concern had been heightened by a newspaper report in 2003 suggesting the convicted paedophile had in fact spent a considerable amount of time in the area of County Sligo from where Bernadette had been abducted. It was now suggested by a local man that in the early 1970s, this journalist had visited Temple House Lake near Ballymote and other places near where Bernadette had disappeared. Two Gardaí, assisted by Northampton police, called to his door. When the detectives introduced themselves and explained why they were there, the man immediately recognised the name Bernadette Connolly. He agreed to meet the detectives voluntarily at the local police station later that day. When he sat down with the detectives, the man was able to recount the name of two Irish detectives he said he'd been interviewed by 30 years before. He told the new investigation team how he had provided the Gardaí at the time with documentary evidence from his employer to prove he had not arrived in Ireland until the 25th of April 1970. He said he had nothing further to add to what he had already said. The detectives travelled back to Ireland with little new information. More recently, this man, now an elderly man, was convicted in England of sexually assaulting another young girl and was given a lengthy prison sentence. The Gardaí have since made inquiries on a number of occasions through the English police about whether he has anything further to tell them as he serves his sentence, and those inquiries continue. In 1999, a man contacted the Gardaí with interesting information. He described how in April 1970, he had been a young boy cycling along a road in County Sligo. He described how, as he cycled past a parked car, the driver had made a lunge for him. The boy managed to evade the man and continued cycling to safety. He had memorised the registration number of the car, and almost 30 years later, he could still recall it. From the number, the Gardaí believed it belonged to a Scottish man who had worked in the Sligo area as a television repairman. Detectives got in touch with their counterparts in Scotland and soon discovered that the man had convictions for sexually abusing boys. One Garda involved in the case says the information was very interesting but didn't lead anywhere. When they checked him out as best they could, all his convictions related to offences against boys. Some people put forward a theory that maybe the fact that Bernadette had her hood up on her anorak, she might have been mistaken as a boy. This witness's ability to remember the car registration number almost 30 years later shows that people can retain vivid memories of traumatic events for decades. Gardaí involved in the case remain convinced there are people still around who know or strongly suspect exactly what happened to Bernadette, the vehicle she was abducted in, the location where she was murdered and the manner of her death, and the route her killer took to Limna Bog. The reality that there are serial killers who attack children was proven in England in 1994 when a Scottish man, Robert Black, was finally convicted of killing three girls over a period of 5 years in the 1980s. Black had abducted and murdered 11-year-old Susan Maxwell from Northumberland in 1982, 5-year-old Caroline Hogg from Edinburgh in 1983, and 10-year-old Sarah Harper from Leeds in 1986. Black was a driver of a poster delivery van who travelled throughout Britain and Ireland during the 1970s and 80s. The bodies of his three known victims were buried within an area of 26 miles wide, encompassing part of three English Midland counties. When Black was convicted, the English police invited the Gardaí to a conference to investigate whether he might be linked to the murder of Bernadette Connolly or the disappearance of Mary Boyle, who I covered in a previous podcast. After some inquiries, it was decided that Black was not the likely suspect for the murder of Bernadette Connolly, but he remains a possible suspect for the disappearance of Mary Boyle. The Gardaí have long wondered whether the person who murdered Bernadette Connolly tried to commit other similar attacks. If Bernadette was attacked by a paedophile travelling throughout Ireland, what stopped the killer from murdering another child? Was the person jailed for other offences and therefore not able to commit any other crimes? Or did he leave the jurisdiction and attack children elsewhere? Was he killed in an accident or did he die of natural causes soon after murdering Bernadette, taking his secret to the grave? Did he continue to assault children in Ireland and somehow decide not to kill again? Or is it that Bernadette Connolly was not the victim of a random abduction but knew her killer? Was the killer someone who set out that day to find a local child to murder? Or did he act on impulse in taking a young girl's life? Had he later any remorse for what he did? Indeed, might he have confided in someone or confessed his evil deed? Is the killer someone who is still living in the northwest of Ireland, who has never come to the attention of Gardaí? These are the questions that have haunted investigators for more than 50 years now, and they are the questions that torment Bernadette's surviving siblings to this day. In December 1971, an inquest was held into Bernadette's death. The jury heard that because the child's body had lain undiscovered for 4 months, it was not possible to establish the exact cause of her death. The coroner told the court something that offered little comfort to the Connolly family, but was nonetheless true. The fact that the inquest into the death of Bernadette Connolly had concluded did not mean that the exhaustive investigations by the Garda authorities into her death had concluded. These investigations would never cease until the mystery of this little girl's terrible and tragic death was solved. More than 50 years later, that mystery remains unsolved. The years following Bernadette's murder brought further tragedy to the Connolly family. 12 years after losing their daughter, they suffered another devastating blow. Maureen Connolly was only 48 years old when she died on the 23rd of July 1982. She had overcome previous ill health when she had gallstones removed, but then she developed bowel cancer and it was diagnosed too late. When Maureen died, her eldest child Anne was 25, while her youngest child, Kerry, born in January 1972, nearly 2 years after Bernadette was murdered, was only 10. Kerry would later reflect on the sadness the family had felt since then. Even when she was out looking for her wedding dress, she found herself thinking about how it was yet another day that neither Bernie nor their mother were there with them. Weddings, christenings, and other family occasions had been robbed from them. And the question of what achievements Bernie might have had, what she might have done with her life, the family had been completely robbed of all that. Gerry Connolly was 72 when he died on the 28th of December 1999. He was deeply affected by the loss of his wife and by the loss of Bernadette. He could not and would not speak to his remaining daughters and son about the murder of their sister. He did speak to his friends who had been around at the time. And in his later years, he spent many hours analysing and reanalysing things people had said and done at the time of Bernadette's disappearance. In the absence of any clear answers about who was responsible for murdering his daughter, Gerry Connolly was tormented by trying to find out who killed his child. One person he often thought about was that student priest who had comforted the family in the weeks before Bernadette's body was found. But Gerry died without answers, without justice, without peace. The loss of Bernadette's possessions, critical evidence that should have been preserved, became another source of anguish for the family. When the fresh review of the murder file was undertaken in 2003, Bernadette's three sisters met Assistant Commissioner Carty and Detective Inspector James Kearns on a number of occasions. The Connollys had many questions about the conduct of the original investigation. In particular, they wanted to know what happened to Bernadette's bike, her medals, and their mother's purse, all of which had been kept by the Gardaí as evidence in the case. Despite an extensive search of all possible sites, the Gardaí involved in the fresh investigation were unable to find Bernadette's possessions. The materials had most probably been sent to Dublin in 1970 for safekeeping during the original murder investigation. But the relevant Gardaí at the time, or in years later, did not have the foresight to keep them in safe storage. As with the loss of evidence from a number of major crimes in the 1970s, the Gardaí did not keep a proper chain of evidence relating to Bernadette's belongings, which greatly frustrated those involved in the fresh review of the case. It also annoyed the original County Sligo Gardaí who had first worked on the case. With advances in forensic science, it was conceivable that hairs or fibres undetectable by the human eye might have been found on Bernadette's bicycle or medals or on the purse. Even if that was not so and there was no prospect of a criminal trial, by right, the items should have been properly preserved. Assistant Commissioner Carty and Detective Inspector Kearns travelled to meet Bernadette's sisters to tell them in person that Bernadette's belongings could not be found. Anne, Patricia and Kerry thanked the Gardaí for their efforts, but insisted that searches and inquiries should continue to find out what exactly happened to their sisters' medals and their mother's purse and her bicycle. Kerry told investigators, "We're going to meet Bernie someday, and we have to do everything we can now to get justice for her, to get answers. At the very least, we want her possessions back. Until then, I'm not going to feel we have done what we could." In Clooney, Anne goes back again in her mind to the time Bernadette disappeared. She has many memories, but for years did not talk about things. It was only since her father died that she has spoken more, because their father found it too upsetting to discuss Bernadette's murder. Anne is now an important source of information for her brother Tommy, for her sisters, and now for her own children. But she still sometimes finds it hard to talk. She remembers for a few days after Bernadette disappeared, the Gardaí asked her to cycle the same route as Bernadette had done, to try to time the journey. Anne was so distressed by what was going on that she simply cycled as fast as she could to get it over and done with. Another distinct memory is of a Garda asking her detailed questions designed to find out if anyone was interfering with her. It was a male Garda who asked her the questions. Anne was only 13 years old and still in a period of innocence. The Garda was asking her if anyone had ever grabbed her chest or grabbed her anywhere else. She was absolutely terrified. He was probably told to question her like this, but Anne remembers running to her mother and she had to be sedated. In recent times, Anne has spoken about the feelings of guilt she had for many years. Naturally, when her little sister was taken away from her in such a violent way, Anne was distraught. Anne and Bernadette had shared a bed and they were best friends. At times after Bernadette's murder, Anne wished she could bring her sister back and take her place in that lane. Part of Anne's grieving involved feelings of regret for the times the two of them may have fought when growing up. Anne would reflect, "You want to remember Bernie for all the happy memories and the way she was laughing and smiling and happy. It actually took me years to get like that. It still upsets me how when I was small, there might have been times when I wasn't nice to her. We were great friends, but like all kids, we might have had rows. For a long time after Bernie was gone, I would think a lot about how I might have been horrible to her about something. I couldn't remember how I was good to her or how we'd have a laugh. I would just remember the times I'd been fighting with her." The old family home in Dura is now gone. The road where Bernadette cycled past Oliver Flynn on the horse and cart that Friday in 1970 is now a 100 kilometre per hour stretch of the N4. The nearby Clunamahan Monastery, where Bernadette spent many happy hours attending a youth club, is now a care facility run by the health service executive. There is nothing to mark the spot where Bernadette's bike was placed by her killer on the embankment above the Lysanina Road. Even today, the road is quiet, with only a few houses set back off the road. It's a scenic drive with the nearby Tuberskanavan Locks visible through the trees. Somewhere in County Sligo or beyond, Bernadette Connolly's pink-rimmed glasses are lying unclaimed. The gold signet ring she wore on her right hand is also still missing. Her tights, underwear and shoes were never found. Bernadette's three sisters and surviving brother are all now parents themselves. Some of Bernadette's nieces and nephews are young adults and know much of the details of the pain that was visited on the family in 1970. Bernadette is laid to rest with her mother and father and younger brother Gerard in Clooney Cemetery. Anne, Tommy, Patricia and Kerry have never been to the spot where their sister's body lay undiscovered for 4 months. Anytime they are driving from Sligo towards Boyle on the Dublin Road, they know the Limna Road is off to the right near Ballinafad, but they have no desire to go near the isolated place where such evil occurred. In the months before her violent death, Bernadette Connolly filled half her English copybook with schoolwork, including spelling corrections where she wrote the correct spelling of each word three times. By April 1970, she had used a ruler to draw margins on 10 pages that she would never get to fill. One of the last things she wrote was that description of herself, the one we heard at the beginning of this episode, dated the 23rd of February 1970. A 10-year-old girl describing herself, her family, her friends, her dreams of becoming a teacher. A bright child who wanted to help others learn, just as she was learning. A devoted sister, a champion dancer, a devout Catholic who wore her medals with pride. Her life was stolen from her on a rainy April afternoon in 1970. Her killer has never been found. If you have any information about the murder of Bernadette Connolly, please contact Sligo Garda Station on 071 915 7000 or email the Serious Crime at sl.crime@garda.ie or Colooney Garda Station on 071 916 7122 or alternatively the Garda Confidential Line on 1800 666 111.
So guys, that's it for today's episode of the Ireland Crimes and Mysteries podcast. Again, thanks for your listenership and don't forget to subscribe to the show and hit that auto download so you never miss an episode. Until the next time, keep your eyes open and your mind curious. This podcast has been compiled from information gathered in the public sphere, like news articles, documentaries, and open source material that can be found on the web. Everything in this podcast is alleged unless a conviction has taken place.